Welcome to the South Carolina New Legacy Podcast. I'm Vicki, and I'm here today with Wayne and Janessa, and we're going to talk a little bit about Black History Month, but first we're going to do a check-in. So our check-in today is, what is one of your favorite memories from school? And I'm going to let Wayne start.
Okay, so hi everybody, this is Wayne. One of my favorite memories definitely was the library. I liked getting books, reading. I would actually get in trouble for reading in class. Yeah, it was absolutely reading.
Reading? Janessa, what's your turn? Your turn, what's your favorite?
My favorite memory from school?
Yeah.
Well, I've been in a lot of different schools, both as a student and as a teacher, so I think that would be really hard to pick, but I think that my favorite memories of school come from being a teacher and from, you know, seeing students develop and improve over time. And when you start out the beginning of the year and your students are really nervous or they don't really know each other yet, and seeing the transformation as a community forms by the end of the year, I think those are my favorite moments.
That is great. I love to learn, so all of school was my favorite, but like Wayne, I like to read. And I read a lot from the library, but one of the best memories specifically from school was getting to go to college for the first time, because that was when I first finally met people who, you know, had similar viewpoints to me, and I felt challenged by not just teachers, but also by my peers. So that's everybody's first great memory of school. So I want to think our next question is going to be on the list is, what is Black History Month? Who wants to start?
I mean, what is Black History Month? So Black History Month is, I guess people just consider it February 1st to February 28th.
It's, good choice.
It's 1 month out of the whole year where school systems, well, I don't believe even all school systems probably in this country, but typically school systems focus
And not just school systems, but other places, museums and things like
focus
that.
Focus on the contributions and the history of black people in America, yeah.
And in a leap year, you get a few extra days even.
Yeah.
Oh, how awesome. I think that you guys answered it anyway. Do we know the history or just...
Yeah, so Black History Month. Well, I mean, this is the Black History Month we think of today. I mean, there are other, there were a few other iterations of weeks that were specific to celebrating Black History previously, but the actual Black History Month that we think of now, from what I can gather, was first proposed by Black educators and students at Kent State University in 1969.
Mm-hmm.
So their school, university, officially celebrated Black History Month in 1970. And then six years later, President Ford recognized Black History Month during the bicentennial celebration of the United States.
So it's a relatively new celebration, yes. Month of celebration, right? Like, that's what it sounds like?
Yeah, fairly new. President Ford urged Americans to, quote, seize the opportunity to honor the too often neglected accomplishments of Black Americans in every area of endeavor throughout our history.
I think that's pretty significant, considering by 1968, I believe that was the year that Martin Luther King was shot.
Yep. Also Robert Kennedy.
Robert Kennedy was shot. And, that was at the Democratic National Convention in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
People were literally beaten in the streets. So America was in an uproar. I mean, riots were breaking out all over the place. And
it was a challenging time.
So whatever I suppose, could be done at a national level to bring some sense of unity,
uh-huh.
some sense of Black people, we see you, we're going to recognize you, and,
right.
was, well, I guess, some step that could have been taken to kind of quiet things down.
And oftentimes, as we've seen in this quote as well, Black History Month is a way that we're honoring the accomplishments of Black Americans, which is very different from saying that we're going to embed the history the true history of African American culture into our curriculum. They're really saying we're going to honor the accomplishments of people who we deem quality Black Americans, rather than looking at the broader picture of African American culture and the history of our country. So
I guess that brings us to our next question. How were you taught about Black History Month in your school? What do you have any specific memories?
So for me, it's an interesting dynamic because I didn't live solely in South Carolina and grow up in the educational system here. So up until third grade, I was educated in schools in other states. And, the big thing I took away from Black History Month, prior to moving to South Carolina was, of course, that, there was Booker T. Washington, there was George Washington Carver. I think I took a deep interest in that because, one, it was,
science.
He was a scientist.
Uh-huh.
Booker T. Washington was an urban planner and had some interest in, well, not some interest, but actually was a part of, drafting the way D.C. looks and was planned out. And love peanut butter, so George Washington Carver was just like, dude, this guy's awesome.
Yeah, also, everybody loves peanut butter, right? Unless you're allergic.
Madam C.J. Walker was, awesome. And then I also, too, remember...
tell us a little bit about Madam C.J. Walker for those who may not know.
Okay, so a quick digression. Madam C.J. Walker was one of the first, I think, Black millionaires.
Yeah, and she was into makeup.
Yeah, not makeup, beauty products, hair care products. Just a powerhouse. I mean, she was the Oprah of her day, I suppose.
Yeah. When I first learned about Madam C.J. Walker, I was like, oh, this is a cool lady. Mm-hmm. Now, you can go back to what you were saying.
So one of the other things that I really liked growing up is that my parents, of course, wanted to make sure that I knew, Black history and people, throughout the American experience. And so I remember at one point we had a board game that was all about Black history. It was like a whole Black history board game.
Okay, I want us to find that board game.
It was kind of set up like Monopoly a little bit.
Uh-huh.
But I remember there being cards with famous Black Americans and just like the whole game was just set up in a really cool way that got you not only engaged but very informed.
If we can find that board game, I will record video us doing that, and we'll put it up as an extra on the website because that sounds awesome.
I will talk to my mother at some point. But after we moved to South Carolina, I don't really remember Black history being so much a thing as just, Black History Month. And then, that's when we would talk about, that would still be the point in which we would talk about, the achievements of Black Americans and what they've contributed to this country. But there is always this sense of, I don't feel like I'm learning enough. I don't feel like, there was certainly no feeling of, the Black American experience is central to the formation and sustenance of this country. Mm-hmm. I remember early on, one of my favorite African Americans was Crispus Attucks.
Ooh, and he was Boston Commons, right?
Yeah. He was one of the first people murdered during the Boston Massacre.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's a sad piece of history, but it proves that
Black Americans have been part of our country's history since the very beginning.
Yeah, but even now, I kind of feel bad not being able to kind of talk a little bit more about what his life was like and who he was before.
Oh, 100%.
Before he took the bullet.
100%.
Yeah, I mean, I went to school in Minnesota growing up, and I think my earliest memory, most prominent early memory about learning about Black history would have been in fifth grade. I think we had talked about it before then, but my memory that's coming to mind is when we read the Harriet Tubman Underground Railroad book. And so that was also a moment where it was the first thing I read in school that I actually was excited to read. So I remember reading that, and I remember there were definitely other books and black figures from history that we read about and talked about in school, but I don't remember any specific Black History Month activities. I don't think our schools really had any, you know, I've heard of schools now having like Black History Festival or things like that. I don't think we really had any events, but we definitely talked about Black history, but it was always very much history. It wasn't really current events. We didn't talk about racism today, especially.
And how what happened all those years ago related to our present situation, right?
Yeah, I think most of, you know, also being in the North, so being in Minnesota, talking about the Civil War, it was very removed from our experience and our history. So coming to South Carolina has been an interesting experience to see how people talk about the Civil War so much differently than we talked about it growing up.
You mean how it's ever present?
Yeah, like that.
And so I remember talking about the Civil War, you know, we talked about the cotton gin and how that was created and just revolutionized cotton picking.
And of course it made slavery worse because it made cotton more profitable.
Right. So we talked about things like that. You know, we talked about the civil rights movement.
We didn't.
You didn't?
No. Granted, I'm older. So the civil rights movement when I was in high school and elementary school was like 20 years ago, essentially. Because I went to school in the 80s and early 90s, right? So we never, ever talked about the civil rights movement.
Yeah, I mean, we talked about, you know, the bus boycotts, we talked about Rosa Parks, we talked about civil rights history, but it was very much history, and it wasn't really across the realm of different subjects or classes. It was confined to literature and history and was very much in the past, and I don't, you know, I could be not remembering everything, but I don't remember anything prominent about connecting it to our own community, especially, you know, Minneapolis and the Twin Cities. I don't recall having any meaningful discussion about racial dynamics in our own community until college.
Yeah. For me, I grew up here in the South in a rural school in the PD. A lot of my teachers were Black. I won't say a majority of, but a lot of them were Black. And so I didn't have any specific Black history memories until high school when I asked one of my history teachers, hey, are we going to do anything special for Black history? And she was like, Vicki, I teach Black history year round. It's part of American history. And that was the end of it with Miss Barr. But Miss Allison, who was our science teacher for biology and physical science, I think, which I took in ninth grade, she required us to do a report on a Black scientist every February and a woman scientist every March. And I think I did mine on Charles Drew, who was the guy who invented the blood transfusion in the 1950s. But her rules were you can't do George Washington Carver. She said she would poke her eyes out if she ever saw another report on George Washington Carver. So we had to find somebody who did something different than that. So we weren't allowed to do Sally Ride for women's history either. So there you go. That's my experience with Black History Month in schools in South Carolina.
Yeah, I want to get back to a point that Janessa brought up, is kind of this fact that as it's being taught, it never feels like it's living or nearby history.
Yeah, it's not connected at all.
Because by the time it was the mid 90s, I was here in South Carolina being educated, and you know, having lived in other states and you know, been, you know, exposed to some of the other like histories of those areas. It was always interesting to me that we were taught history in a way that was like, you know, well, that happened in the past, and there wasn't, like you were saying, that how does it connect to kind of where we are now? Like how, because at some point, you know, things had to happen between, you know, that one bit that we consider like history and so long ago, and that's over.
The irony of my education experience is I was being taught by teachers who started their teaching careers in segregated schools, a lot of them. If they started their teaching career before the mid-1960s, and I did have some old lady teachers, they weren't teaching in an integrated school. They were teaching in a segregated school. And I think that's important to remember how close and present it is.
I think that's a great point as well, because I remember being taught mostly by a lot of maybe people who were largely women, but they were largely, I want to say, maybe in their 30s. There might have been a few in their 40s. I remember one teacher when I was really young and living in Maryland. She might have been in, you know, her 50s,
mm-hmm.
maybe. And even at that time, I think living in Maryland, that still might have been the late 80s. So, yeah.
Yeah, I think it's important to remember that how close this is. This is new stuff. Like my mother graduated high school from a segregated school. The next year, my aunt, who was still in high school, they integrated everything finally, and that was like 1971 or something like that. So my dad, who is a school teacher, he started teaching in integrated schools. So, and he retired in 98. So anybody that retired like in the 80s or early 90s, they might have started in a school that was not integrated.
Well, and our schools today aren't all that integrated either.
To be completely fair, you are right.
Today, our schools are so segregated as well.
Uh-huh.
And so I think that a lot of times, depending on whether you're in a white school or a black school or a Latino school, the way that teachers approach black history might differ. And I've heard from, some people like, well, I don't really have black students, so why would I need to teach that sometimes?
You need to teach it more.
People really emphasize, because they're not thinking about being, culturally responsive to students if you feel like your student body isn't really diverse in that way. I think that can definitely impact the mentality that some teachers have when they approach the curriculum.
Yeah.
Whereas if you're in a predominantly black school, I think it's hopefully something that the teachers are emphasizing, in the way that they approach their teaching and curriculum, but it is something that everybody needs to learn, and we need to have more more representation around the year when it comes to black history.
So Janessa, I know you've done a little research on this. Do we know how it's being taught today in 2019?
Yeah. So to give a little bit of background about South Carolina history textbooks, from the 1920s to the 1980s, the textbooks in South Carolina were written by a woman named Mary C. Sims Oliphant, who beforehand, her father, I believe, her father or her grandfather.
It was her grandfather, and he wrote it before started writing it before the Civil War started.
Yeah, so she was asked to, do an update to the textbooks. And so from the 1920s to the 1980s, we used editions of her textbooks in South Carolina. And
I believe I was taught third grade history from her textbook.
They were definitely supportive of white supremacy and were highly racist. And there were some quotes. To quote one of her textbooks, one section of the textbook, quote, "The sight of the mounted Klansmen in their white robes was enough to terrorize the Negroes. When the courts did not punish Negroes who were supposed to have committed crimes, the Klan punished them," end quote.
Oh, that's a fun quote.
So there were definitely, it's not, not just racist, but white supremacist. I don't know if that's really a not this, but that statement.
Uh-huh.
But the textbooks really were perpetuating white supremacy up until the 1980s.
Well, I'm going to let Wayne talk.
Yeah, because that sounds literally as if you're telling the student, well, if the courts didn't work, then here was this vigilante group of unknown white people in hoods, that I'm pretty sure the people in the local area knew who they were, because they were most likely the judge and the cops and, some neighborhood doctor,
Or your neighborhood farmer.
Hell, it could have been your neighbor, just period.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
Or even
your parents.
Well, not even just your parents, but the main farmer on whose land that your family was sharecropping on.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It could have been a host of people. That's frightening.
Yeah.
So this is one excerpt, but this really, I think, is one of the quotes that gives you the biggest idea of what was really being taught. And mm-hmm. textbooks are available online if you're interested in reading more about what's actually in them.
Oh, absolutely.
There are also, several articles. There was an article by the Charleston City Paper that went through and highlighted some of the...
I'm going to add some to your thing. One of the things that the Daughters of the Confederacy did after the Civil War was they created these textbook panels where they had to approve the textbook before it could go into a classroom. And they did that with the government. So it was reinforcing white supremacy via the South Carolina government and other states as well, because this wasn't just limited to South Carolina. And they didn't want anything that spoke badly about their ancestors in those textbooks. So, like, if you told the truth about Denmark Vesey or the Stono Rebellion, we were talking about that before we got started, then you weren't going to get your book into the schools or the classrooms.
Yeah, because those people were terrorists.
Yeah.
Well, and I think that the textbooks really were very much about putting people in their place and emphasizing the racial mm-hmm. hierarchy. And so that's kind of what the history of what those textbooks looks like in South Carolina up until the 1980s. So then we get to 1984.
Mm-hmm.
South Carolina state lawmakers then recognized that we needed a broader, more inclusive portrayal of American history that would, quote, recognize the experiences, culture, and contributions of African Americans. So in 1984, the Education Improvement Act was passed. And that stipulated by 1989 to 1990 school year, each public school in the state of South Carolina must instruct students in the history of the black people as a regular part of its history and social studies courses. So that passed in 1984. Then we fast forward until now. So we now have an education oversight committee that is supposed to be monitoring and making sure that our curriculum is up to standards, that it's quality curriculum, we're teaching what we're supposed to teach. So in the last couple of years, the Avery Research Institute in the College of Charleston was commissioned by the Education Oversight Committee to follow up on the level of African American history being taught. And it was determined that while many schools observed on some level African American history, the practice of teaching an African American curriculum was very random and yielded little measurable results, and that most teachers faced barriers. Most common barriers were a lack of knowledge of the content and a lack of awareness of the law itself. So schools were not equipped, teachers were not equipped to actually teach African American history.
Hmm. That seems like a point of outreach we could do with the Modjeska School, I'm just saying.
Yeah, so that's kind of where we're at today.
Yeah, so...
I wonder how that varies across the state, because we certainly have areas of the state where you have much higher African-American populations.
Yeah.
But those schools are also...
staffed by white people.
Well, not just staffed by white people, they're just in a sad... kind of performance uh-huh. state in general.
Yeah.
So do they even have the resources to do that education?
Right.
Yeah.
And on the reverse side, for some of the areas where they have higher resources or are higher white, student body populations, is this even, an area where they think it's important to really teach?
Right.
Or is it kind of just, stuck in the month of February and,
right.
Yeah.
Give me your project and...
And let's move on.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I can see that point because, again, like I said, Women's History Month is in March and it's probably much the same.
And to say that you had a teacher who was especially, focusing on, it's March, it's Women's Month, let's do some research on a woman and, show me what you got. I'm pretty sure that was largely isolated to your school.
It probably was. Miss Allison valued black history and women's history and made sure that her students knew it. And it wasn't like an extra credit project in our science class. It was for a grade. It was a paper that she graded. My Women's History Month project that I remember was Valentina Tereshkova. And I ran across she was the first woman in space since I couldn't do Sally Ride You know, I did Valentina Tereshkova, who was a German, a Russian woman who went to space in like the 60s.
Yeah, because there was, and I went to Heathwood Hall for my secondary education, and I don't ever recall something coming up specifically for Women's Month or there being a Women's Month.
Yeah, and I had good teachers. I went into a school that was adjacent to the Corridor of Shame, which Wayne was alluding to. It's the I-95 corridor where a lot of impoverished people are, mostly African Americans. And I just happened to be adjacent to it. I've been in those schools many times for sporting events and things like that. But I had good teachers who made sure that I was educated. Ms. Barr, I mentioned her earlier, was a... Both of these ladies are deceased. God rest their souls, as they say. And they were good teachers, and I couldn't have asked for better.
Yeah, I think that something that... So with Wayne alluding to this, so this dual issue that we have between the quality of the way that in which African-American history is embedded into our curriculum. So there's the fact of teaching African-American history, and then there's the fact of teaching African-American students in a quality education setting altogether.
Yeah.
And I think one thing we've learned through this infamous Corridor of Shame court case about the large opportunity gap and resource gap for students is that even when there is a law in place that says we're supposed to teach this or that says you should have a safe classroom to learn in, doesn't mean it's going to translate into action. And even when it was found after, was it a decade-long court battle,
yep,
the schools were in violation of
the law.
They
didn't do anything about it.
They didn't do anything about it. And then it was sort of dismissed in saying it's kind of impossible to fix at this point, so it would be an unrealistic expectation to set for the schools to fix it.
Yeah, because the legislature actively fought the case continuing.
Yeah.
Right. So it's a little bit... It's great that these things are written in policy, that we should have protections and that we should have, you know, equitable representation in our history. But then how is it actually being implemented and how do we move forward and make sure it is getting there? Because we have a lot of ground to make up when you think about the fact that until 1984 we were still using
a racist textbook. And we used it considerably after 1984 because I was in third grade from 86 to 87 and I remember reading that textbook. And I'm sure there had been modifications to remove some of the more egregious comments, i.e. that line out of it. But it was still an old font textbook that I remember 100%.
Right. Well, and then even in, what was it, 2015, was that as recent as it was when the Texas textbooks were talking about, it basically was saying that the laborers from Africa moved or emigrated.
So the state of Texas, because they purchase so many books, they tend to set the standard of what gets published, and there was a whitewashing of slavery in those textbooks. They essentially didn't even, you know, call them slaves.
They very carefully avoided using that word, in fact.
Well, yeah, because, you know, the conservative government, and I say this as a Texan, so everybody be offended, but the conservative, you know, politicians and just this conservative, like, ideology that seems to run through the people that sit in places of power or authority in Texas is just so regressive.
Yep.
It literally makes no sense in the 21st century.
Mm-hmm. And we could go on about that. But let's move on and do one last question. How do you think it should be taught in going forward?
So I think it would be taught, I think it should be taught, you know, as a year-round thing, you know, because...
You and Ms. Barr would get along real well.
Yeah, because the contributions of black people in America have literally been everywhere. I mean, from the ground, from literally the before the founding of this nation, you know, up until today.
Yeah. Well, Sarah and I went to something. Sarah was a guest on the last pod, if you don't remember. She and I went to something called the Slave Dwelling Conference. And one of the things that I learned there was that at a lot of old buildings, you can look at the bricks and you can see the handprints of the literal Africans who made the bricks that were used to build the homes and buildings and things around structures that built the nation, literally built the nation. One example, if you guys get a chance, go to Siebel's house and look for that, because there are some there. That's the oldest house in Columbia, South Carolina. We also, you know, have the people about, we talked about the boatmen who traveled around Charleston and how they delivered the news. There was a paper on that. And there was a paper on a guy named John Williams that I found fascinating. He was a master builder who built the lady who did Indigo, Eliza Lucas. Like, she got married, and he was a master builder who was essentially a project manager. He was a construction manager who was managing labor, paying labor, like mostly free. I won't say they were free African Americans, so we don't know that, but they were enslaved African Americans who were allowed to receive pay. And he built this amazing, beautiful building that was one of the stars of the Charleston architecture scene. And people don't know about him because he was a slave. And he was one of the big reasons that Eliza Lucas was able to invent her process for indigo, because she was a botanist. And she worked very closely with him. Eventually, he was freed and was able to buy the freedom of his children. But nobody knows about him. It's their contributions have been around since the 1700s, which was when this was happening.
Yeah.
And people don't know.
And so that's why I think, you know, there should be a conscious effort,
mm-hmm.
you know, no matter what the subject, you know, there should be some investigation mm-hmm. as to how Black people contributed to that. Certainly, you know, if I can find that game that I was discussing, but educational games, you know, even in the form of trivia, one way that we incorporate
mm-hmm.
Black, you know, African American and Black history into just the overall curriculum.
But it also has to go beyond that. It can't stop with just a Holidays and Heroes approach to African American history.
Sorry.
So it can't stop with just a Holidays and Heroes approach, because if you have a board game that's really engaging and you've got people learning about, you know, civil rights activists, important people in African American history, you still are teaching it within the traditional Eurocentric history model.
Mm-hmm.
We're not transforming the curriculum. We're not having social justice orientation to what we're teaching. We're teaching it and we're moving on. And so there's a board game called The Road to Racial Justice, which is another educator project that it's free to get online. But where you take the history, but you also put it into local or modern day context and give students tools to actually address racism when they see it in their communities.
Mm-hmm.
That is awesome.
Yeah, because that's ultimately, I think, where we have to get to is really centering the experience of Black people in this country when we discuss the history. You know, at some point we have to address, and this is perhaps, you know, a bigger point just to, like, our generation as millennials and going forward. We have to speak to the truth of this country in teaching our history.
Mm-hmm.
You
yep.
know, America, the United States of America is not just this great beneficial, you know.
Yeah, we have to.
On the hill, you know, that
mm-hmm.
nobody thinks of us as a light on the hill anymore. Let's
nobody,
just be.
Nobody really thought of us that way
yeah.
before. I mean.
But you're absolutely right. We've got to acknowledge the for lack of a better word, the ugliness of our past.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, I don't even think it's the ugliness. I just quite frankly think it's the reality.
Yeah.
So, I mean, sure, we have some bright spots. We did some good stuff, but, you know.
We've also been...
Yeah, we started off crappy.
Started off crappy, exactly. So, go ahead.
What I want to say, so my master's degree is in multicultural curriculum and instruction, so this is obviously a topic I feel very passionately about and could speak about for hours and hours. So if anyone wants to reach out to me and talk about it, we can. But I think that this is something that when it comes to Black History Month, which is what we kind of started talking about,
mm-hmm.
we have this month. And on one hand, I think it is important to celebrate, to have a month where we recognize and bring to the forefront the stories of groups that have been historically marginalized, and to to emphasize that this is something that is not being addressed correctly in the school system, so we're making space for something that, that isn't being taught, mm-hmm. but that's that should not become an excuse for not embedding it into their curriculum in a better way. And so often it can be frustrating to teachers who are trying so hard to be great, you know, multicultural educators, who feel like this is the only time people want to ask, what should I do for, you know, you talk about African-American history sometimes, what should I do in my class for this month? And so it can be hard for some of those educators who want to kind of back away and say, this is a facade, this isn't true multicultural education. But it's also an opportunity to try to reach across the aisle and give resources and say, here's something you can do for now, and here's how I would, you know, make it better or make it more critical, and maybe we can collaborate next month on a project, mm-hmm. or try to bridge it out into like a more interdisciplinary, critical, transformative curricular approach rather than just
here's this month
holiday and hero and move on. So
yeah,
I mean, but it's better than doing nothing. You know, it is the first step of the stages of multicultural education, but obviously we can't stop there.
Yeah. So I think that we should wrap up now, because we've been talking a good long time. And so I want to end on what's for you out there. Tell us what's one history, Black History Month memory that you have when you were a kid. Maybe y'all remember something differently than us. So hit us up on our Twitter, which is SC_NewLegacy.
SC_NewLegacy.
And our Facebook, which is at facebook.com/SCNLP. And our Instagram, which is the same as our Twitter. So maybe tell us a little bit about that. And thank you, Janessa and Wayne, for joining me today. And let's leave it here. See you after the break. Bye. Welcome back to the South Carolina New Legacy Podcast. I'm Vicki, and I'm here to talk to you today about some events that are happening in Columbia, South Carolina over the next few months. We are going to start with a civil rights exhibit that's happening at the University of South Carolina at the Ernest Holling Special Collection. On Thursday, Dr. Bobby Donaldson will be giving a talk, and we will have the details in our description below and perhaps on our Facebook page. You don't have to pay anything for the event, but you do have to register. The next thing I'm going to talk about here is the Monuments Tour. The South Carolina Progressive Network's Monuments Tour group is going to be meeting at the African American Monument at Sunday, February 10th at 3:30 p.m. And we are going to be doing the Legacy of the Confederacy again, which is a tour we did back in May of last year. We hope that you'll join us. We look forward to seeing you. The third thing on my list is the Democracy 2020, which will be held here at 2015 Marion Street, which is the building next to the Majeska Simpkins House. We will be talking from 10 a.m. to 12 p.m. about the census that's coming up in 2020 and how we can organize around the census. And from 1 to 4 p.m. we'll be talking about gerrymandering. And we hope to have a special guest from Mississippi for that. The fourth thing on my list is the Spring Conference, which will be happening in Sand Hills in Northeast Columbia at the Clemson Extension. We will be talking about that more as we get closer to it, but for more information about the South Carolina Progressive Network Spring Conference, please look on the South Carolina Progressive Network website. We'll link it below in the description. And the last thing I'm going to talk about today is the Majeska Simpkins School for Human Rights. That will begin March 18th and run through June. We usually have class every other Monday, and we hope that you can join and that you can talk to us about it. And so if you're interested in attending the Majeska School for Human Rights, something that we've talked about a lot in this podcast so far, please email network@scpronet.com. We look forward to seeing you in March if you wish to join us. I hope you'll come to some of these events at least. I think that we'll have a good time and you'll learn a lot. So without further ado, I'm going to get on to the next part of our show. Talk to you soon.
Welcome back to the New Legacy Podcast. This is Wayne Borders. I'm joined again by Omari and Vicki. We're going to be discussing an event that the New Legacy Project has put on in the past, and how we're kind of moving forward with it, called the Subversive Art Festival Extravaganza.
Or better known as SAFE.
So the idea for the Subversive Art Festival Extravaganza, SAFE, was brought about as a way for us to use art to help educate young people. And so we thought, you know, one of the best ways to do that would be to kind of make it into a party atmosphere. And so we've had two large SAFE gatherings, and we're kind of redefining how we want to do it going forward.
So let's talk about what we had at the first and second SAFE, how we orchestrated that, mm-hmm. before we talk about how we change it. What do you think?
Yeah, so I'll turn that over to Amari. And I'll preface this by saying when we organized the first SAFE, I actually couldn't go.
I did not go to the first SAFE either. I only went to the second, but I wasn't involved in the Progressive Network until the second one.
Oh, welcome aboard. Glad to have you here. So the first one was at TAPS, and had an interesting format because on both sides of the room, we basically would alternate the performances. So you'd have a host on one side of the room, cueing that act up, and then the host kind of engaging the audience. So we got almost a 360 effect as far as audience engagement. A little bit of everything. It kind of ran like in segments. So it's like if you couldn't come to the early evening, maybe you came for that 8 to 10 slot. If you couldn't come then you kind of caught, you know, the closing acts. But it was pretty full through and through. A lot of diverse content. Some of it protests. Some of it just kind of artists doing their thing and letting the community know there's other, you know, ways to be heard and seen. Visually and all through all the performing arts.
So tell us a little bit about the kind of content that we had.
We had comedy. We had a little kind of like these little mini skits where we'd offer a little like South Carolina tidbits about different facts and things like that. It's been a few years since that first one.
There was kind of an installation where it was kind of like a long piece of paper and people were writing, what was it, affirmations or...
Yeah, it was a few different things, but it was kind of like a community check-in board, but we wanted to kind of steer the dialogue a little bit to just what folks were, you know, were going on and going through in their various communities. So, yeah.
That sounds like a great event. I know that when we did the second one was when I came sort of aboard of the network, and one of the things I really enjoyed at that one was the diversity of acts, but we also had a interactive poetry thing where we took a speech that was delivered by President Trump. I think it was his inauguration speech.
Yes.
And we cut it up and people were making poetry from that. I just thought that was a beautiful thing.
Yeah. So the second SAFE that we had, the theme largely running through it was a lot of the work that we have put into our State of the Youth project. And there were blurbs and data points on a large screen behind the bands as they were playing, kind of cycling through some of that information. There was poetry. It was extremely, extremely good.
Good comedy as well.
Very. And we kind of finished that off with the destruction of a pinata facade of the State House.
Yeah, Wayne and I built that.
Yeah.
We were very proud of ourselves. Yeah. A lot of hot glue and paper mache in that thing.
Yeah, it was great. Uh-huh. So moving forward, you know, we still want SAFE to be something that people can engage with and come to, but we're in a moment of transition.
Yeah, like what's the next level?
Yeah.
To it, yeah. You know? So because the collective has been talking about going from, you know, the large scale version of SAFE that we've had, you know, these past two times into somewhat of a smaller,
almost portable SAFE
iteration.
Yeah, ongoing series.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So what does that look like in terms of, you know, how themed should those next iterations be of SAFE?
Well, I think that we should personally, and this is just my opinion, which I voice loudly in many things. And the guys around me are nodding. So I think that we should center it around specific issues. Like racial justice is one that I care about. History and white supremacy is another. And there is a lot of other things we do, like voting, mm-hmm. that I think we could center it around. Maybe even our census work.
Yeah, I think with the network, all of us have a pretty large wheelhouse of like what the network works on.
Yeah.
Like kind of what I'm envisioning, especially, you know, with recent circumstances, is some kind of like walkthrough or documentary, and maybe have some folks who lived in Allen Benedict Court,
mm-hmm.
just like telling some stories and narratives, and maybe that wouldn't be the safe, so to speak, but the documentary of it could be like
part
replayed
of safe.
During it. We could play excerpts of interviews and things like that. And I didn't get a chance to research the folks' names who passed away, you know, but I definitely want to lift them up. You know,
yeah, absolutely.
Keep that spirit alive.
So the situation that Omari just alluded to with the Allen Benedict Courts, it was one of the oldest, possibly the second or third oldest public housing project in the United States. It's located just a little north of the Benedict campus in downtown Columbia. Due to a gas leak, two people in different units died. And since then, there's been a lot of activity around, you know, the fire department, you know, mm-hmm. wanting to be in on, you know, further inspections of the buildings. But, you know, certainly after those two people were found dead, they decided to close the housing development. And, you know, there's also this push to not only condemn it, but to also like raise the site.
Yeah.
In the same way they did with Gonzalez Gardens.
We're definitely going to get more into that. I think Kurt is planning to do a bit of a special on it. So we might release that as some bonus content for you with more detail, because I think it's important to talk about.
And this is probably something else kind of inspired by how you have approached the Monuments Project. Is I kind of see the city, especially with the names of the streets, the whole landscape,
mm-hmm.
kind of maybe could be our playground in this next iteration, especially if we do it as a series of different kinds of
mm-hmm.
offerings over a period of time.
You know what I think would be really mm-hmm. cool mm-hmm. is like if we had people do monuments, create their own monuments to people that matter to them.
Absolutely.
Things that we would replace the mm-hmm. what's on the State House grounds, because I have a few, mm-hmm. and I'm not a great artist, but I am a fair one, mm-hmm. and I would be willing to add something to that.
See, and that sounds like a great idea for our next, I guess, chapter of SAFE.
Yeah.
Would be to invite community members to do something like that. And depending on, especially if we engage different communities, we could make it almost like a community-wide project.
Yep.
You know, and say, you know, well, we've got people in this other community too who are going to get together and work on the same thing, and so.
But from a different perspective, yeah. I think that'd be a good idea. I'd love for us to do that. That sounds amazing to me.
Yeah. One thing I want to mention is a Charleston artist named Colin Kwashi. And what he did, I forget what year he did it in, maybe 20 years or so, but he would have a frame, and it would be on a stand, and it would be, the frame would basically be aimed at some building of significance in Charleston.
Uh-huh.
So like the hotel that used to be the Citadel, downtown Charleston, mm-hmm. and then, you know, the Citadel and Denmark VC, and that whole narrative,
mm-hmm.
And all the, you know, all the kind of challenge and contested places in Charleston. But maybe, and I guess we haven't really figured out the final iteration or iterations of what this next SAFE will be.
Yeah, we're
but
playing
I kinda
around
like
with
the fluidity
it.
Of it.
Yeah,
it's
I
like
agree.
It's kind of, you know, it can be anything as possible at this point. So, yeah.
So what would we do in Columbia with regards to the frame? Would we frame... Mm-hmm. sites like he did down in Charleston, or would we...
I think so. Maybe we could add our own twist to it.
Frame sites that were important to people of color that have been forgotten, like what has happened with some of the redevelopment that happened down along Assembly Street back in the day. That used to be a very vibrant community of people of color that has been sort of forgotten.
And then definitely not to lose the performance element. I mean, there's a lot of kind of flash mob opportunities to maybe perform at those sites.
Yep.
And then as we kind of dialogue with different communities, I'm sure there's probably a place or a location near and dear to folks where they wouldn't mind having some folks coming in and kind of sharing some energy with them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not just telling their narratives, but some kind of maybe celebration or performance element, you know, definitely with the community's blessing.
I think that would be a good idea. Mm-hmm. Wayne, you got anything else that you think would be awesome?
Well, not at the moment, because I don't want the podcast to turn into a meeting, but we are notorious.
Yeah, we love talking about stuff like this. Yeah. We're idea people, but we're also a little bit of a project manager type, so we'll make them happen, we promise.
Yeah.
So tell us what the purpose of SAFE would be.
So
going forward and in the past.
So I think we still want to keep the mission of using art as the vehicle to educate people about civics and their local history and how they can interact with within their community structures and institutions.
Yeah.
So I think that we simply maintain that mission.
Yeah.
But certainly, you know, the activities, you know, should be up for discussion. Because I will say that I've really gotten to enjoy, you know, watching us work with local bands, local artists, you know, us milling about our own ideas, like how do we like draw people in, make them feel engaged while they're there at the event, rather than just, you know,
standing there watching a band.
Show up and we'll do this.
Like, yeah.
Little
yeah.
dance. Yeah.
Jazz hands.
Yeah. Always jazz hands.
Yeah. So that's, I really enjoy SAFE. I want to continue to enjoy it, and I want the community to enjoy it. But one of the best parts about it was the participatory aspect with the poetry and then the pinata situation. Yeah. And I love bands, and I think that it would be a good opportunity to engage the community and have them tell their stories some too. Perhaps there would be a way to incorporate some narratives into SAFE about events like you were talking about, the Island Benedict Court folks. That's part of a little documentary.
Yeah, sky's the limit.
Yep, so I agree. So I think that we are going to be done. I hope that you'll attend some of those events I mentioned earlier and that you'll join us in another couple of weeks for the next podcast. I guess one of the things we can talk about is, like, I want to remind you to engage with us and tell us some of your favorite Black history heroes that you think should be memorialized and remembered more, because we definitely want to do that. Mm-hmm. And our Twitter is SC_New Legacy. So engage with us there. Our Instagram is also SC_New Legacy. And our Facebook page is facebook.com/SCNLP, or you can just search for the South Carolina New Legacy Project and you'll probably find us. There aren't very many of those on Facebook. So thank you so much for your time, guys. I appreciate it, and looking forward to talking to you next time.
All right.
Thank you. Tell your friends.
Thanks, y'all. See you.